How's it going, Niall? Welcome to another episode of In Your Nature podcast.
I'm very good, Ricky. Great to be talking to you. And hello to all of our listeners. We've been getting great feedback over the last few weeks about our third series or season of this podcast. So thanks all for your kind words and for listening in. We really do appreciate it. And just to start, as we always do, by saying that the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. And this podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.
This episode is about a thing that is very birdy, and that is bird eggs, and a fascinating topic, really, and a fascinating little sort of quirk of the bird world is the fact that they lay eggs. And let's go right back. What's an egg and why do birds lay them?
Well, I suppose in many ways, egg laying is the default for many natural creatures. We humans, at least the females among us, give birth to live young, as do most mammals, though not all mammals. But that itself in nature is a bit of an anomaly, because obviously carrying your offspring inside your body, there's advantages in terms of being able to protect your young more and able to control their temperature better and so on and provide them with nourishment. But there's risks there as well, because it can be cumbersome. It can interfere with other aspects of survival in wild animals. So most animals have evolved a strategy whereby their offspring develop in eggs outside of the body, and of course that started long before birds came on the scene. If you think about fish, obviously, and amphibians and insects laying, or at least in the vast majority of cases, laying eggs. So laying eggs isn't something that's unique to birds by any means, but it is something I think that birds have perfected in a way that no other creature has, because it's something we very much associate with them. It's a very visible way in which they behave, and of course that every single bird that we happen to hear or see on any given day once hatched out of an egg. There's no other way for a bird to come into the world, so I find that really fascinating. And I think that natural selection and evolution has made the bird's egg one of the most perfect things in all of nature, just this amazing little machine for bringing new life into the world. I just find them incredible.
Yeah, it's like just a little oven, a little vessel to cook up that little baby bird and protect it in the meantime. And yeah, so it's a very good adaptation to what they need to do. And it also allows you to have multiple offspring, and sort of in some animal groups, many multiples, even thousands in some cases, which is quite amazing. Now, birds don't quite go to the thousands, but we have birds that specialise in just having one and taking care of that as best they can. And then some of them hedge their bets and maybe have upwards of nearly 20. So that's so the albatrosses, for example, only have one normally. And then the likes of blue tits, I mean, can have up to sort of 16. The pheasants and partridges get up near 20 sometimes. Yeah, so there's different strategies there.
There are. I think a lot of it comes down to, well, two things really. One is how long that bird would live on average, because that tends to influence how many eggs they would lay. So birds like albatrosses, which tend to be very long-lived, it makes more sense for them, because they have so many breeding years ahead of them, it makes more sense for them to invest all their time and energy and effort into that one egg and doing everything they can to get that chick up and flying, rather than, you know, spread themselves too thinly, have you know, and have lots of eggs they have to look after. There's a strategy that they can play the long game. If you're a bird like a blue tit or a robin or a wren, life for you is going to be a lot shorter. You know, albatrosses can live for many, many decades, whereas your robins and your blue tits, they're going to live for 2-3 years, 4 years if they're doing really well, but that's about it. So they don't have so many years to get it right. So as a bit of an insurance policy, they tend to have far more eggs in one go. And then you have some of the game birds, you know, like the pheasants and the partridges, that tend to have big clutches as well. A lot of ducks are the same. In many ways, it's because most of those are ground nesting birds. Their eggs are perhaps more vulnerable than birds that are tucked away maybe inside a nest box or a tree cavity, or even high up in a tree or in a bush. They're more vulnerable. So you tend to see often that they would lay more eggs because it's a higher attrition rate. They lose more of them to predators or to flooding events and so on. And also a lot of those birds tend to have more camouflaged eggs. Either in the case of ducks, they'll camouflage them by setting themselves in the nest, by covering them over, putting down on them. Or in the case of the partridges and the pheasants, the gulls, the terns, many of the waders that nest on the ground, their eggs tend to be very mottled. So they blend in with the heather or the stones or whatever the background would be. Whereas a lot of birds that would nest inside cavities, look at woodpeckers, for example, their eggs tend to be pure white. There's no need for them to have any colour on them at all, because they don't need camouflage. No, nobody can see them. And that's something we also see in much of the rest of the natural world. So looking at creatures that aren't birds that lay eggs, if you look at many reptiles would lay eggs that are white, but they bury them underground where they're less visible. And so it's different strategies, but it's not something that developed with the birds. I think birds have taken it to its ultimate perfection, though, with the different patterns and colours that you can get on eggs, which, you know, I think is one of the most fascinating things about them, to be honest.
How are they made? I mean, the process up until the shell making process is very much what people would be familiar with in mammals or even humans or whatever it is. There's oviducts and there's the uterus and it releases the egg and then the sperm fertilizes it and then it comes down the sort of canal and that sort of process begins. And then it gets to a certain point and the shell then is formed.
Yes, and it really is remarkable how it happens. So birds do have ovaries, but the funny thing is in all modern birds, only one of their two ovaries actually works. One of them is a vestigial one that has no function anymore and doesn't function. So all the female birds laying eggs, it all comes from one ovary and one oviduct. And look, an egg itself is actually a single cell. So the ostrich egg is the biggest cell that we know of on Earth at the moment, because it has its nucleus, it has all the other parts that a cell would have. And then within that, obviously, new cells then develop as the embryo gradually develops if the egg has been fertilized. So in the case of most commercial chicken eggs, for example, they're not fertilized. There's no matter how long they're incubated, no chick is ever going to hatch out of that. And that can happen with wild birds as well, but it's much rarer that happens, because the female invests so much energy and nutrition from her body into creating those eggs. So essentially what happens is you have the nucleus of the egg, and then with inside the female's body, she may have several eggs on the go at a time. But usually she'll only lay one egg per day or every second day, really. It depends on the size of the bird and how well it's been feeding. But it's not like, unlike with many fish or insects or reptiles or amphibians, where they lay hundreds of thousands of eggs in one go. That's not the way birds do it. It's one at a time for them. And what happens is then that you have the cell and the embryo inside the egg when it's been fertilized, but then you also have the other components. So you have the albumin of the egg, the white of the egg, that serves several functions. That's a protective barrier, a bit of a shock absorber around the creature. It also has, when the embryo is developing, it also has moisture in there, so that's a source of fluid and water for the bird. Then you have the yolk of the egg, and sometimes people think that the yolk is what becomes the chick, only indirectly. That's the food supply for the growing chick embryo inside that egg, because unlike most mammals, birds obviously don't have placentas, they're not connected to their mothers, so nutrition doesn't pass that way. So all the nutrients that chick needs to grow have to be in that yolk that's inside the egg. And then when that's all formed and the membrane is around the egg, then it takes about 24 hours or so for the female to put the shell on the egg, and then it's kind of spray painted in many species with a kind of color inside. It's kind of spun round as it's developing. It hardens very quickly. The shell of an egg is made of calcium carbonate, which is the same substance that makes snail shells, for example, exactly the same stuff. So it's nice and hard and protected, but it's full of little holes. It's porous. It's not by any means a hermetically sealed thing. So all the time that embryo, the chick, is inside the egg, it's breathing. It's able to breathe through those pores in the eggshell. Which is why, you know, unlike a lot of other creatures like frogs, for example, that would put their eggs in water, a bird couldn't do that, because the chicken side would literally drown, because it wouldn't be able to breathe any of the air because of the water. And then the egg is laid, and interestingly, it's not laid the way you would think. It's laid blunt end first, rather than pointed end first, which I always found a little bit strange, but that's the way nature does it.
I discovered that by mistake whilst trying to catch a hen in the garden, and she decided to deposit the egg whilst sort of running away from me, and then the blunt end came first. I was quite surprised by that. Yeah, it's funny. And we actually know a lot about eggs because of laying hens. It's sort of, they've been the crash test dummies for scientists for years. And so we do know a lot about the process and bird eggs through hens. It's really interesting. Also an interesting thing about the shape of the egg is that coming down the oviduct or whatever is there, it's already formed. The shape, people think that the shape is formed when the shell is made, but it's not. If it for some reason skipped the stage where the shell is produced, it would still come out oval or elliptical or whatever shape the bird's egg would be. So that's already sort of predefined.
Yes, that's right. So it's set by this membrane, which is a very particular ovoid shape. Different birds, and you know a bird egg immediately when you see it, but some are more pointed, some are a bit rounder, but the chicken's egg is a classic example of a very typical shaped egg for most birds. And yeah, it's formed by that membrane inside the oviduct as it's being formed. And you can actually do this, it's a great experiment, it's fun to do with kids. If you get a chicken's egg and you put it in a jar of vinegar, For a while. What happens is the vinegar will remove that calcium carbonate. It just dissolves completely in the vinegar, produces carbon dioxide, the liquid goes all fizzy. It's really funny. But then what you're left behind is you're still left this perfect egg shape, but it's all squishy like a bouncy rubber ball. And that's the membrane itself. And you can see that the membrane is giving it the shape and the shell comes after the shape of the egg is formed. You're quite right.
Kids are actually obsessed with those weird little jelly eggs. They're like aliens that hatch out the minute you put them in water. So we'll do the reverse. It'll be a bit cheaper, this one. And back to the calcium carbonate, it's really interesting. So you need something hard enough to sort of withstand the weight of an incubating mum or dad, so it has to be sort of rigid, but you also need something fragile enough for the chick to break out of.
Yes, that's right, and the breaking out is a serious process for those chicks, and I've been privileged to see gulls hatching out on several occasions, and it really is quite remarkable. It takes a huge effort, and in some cases it takes more than a day for that chick to get out of the egg. And what's really interesting, it's very rare in the natural world that the parent birds will actually help the chick get out of the egg. They kind of leave them to it completely. And one of the theories behind that is it's the ultimate survival of the fittest test. If that chick is not fit and healthy and strong enough to be able to get itself out of its own egg, there's no point in mum and dad investing any further care or resources into it, so you may as well let it die because it's not fit enough to survive. It sounds so harsh, but that's the way nature is. So they do it, and what they do is they roll over on their backs inside the eggshell, and they have a little, in most species at least, a little egg tooth on the tip of their beak, just above it. It's a little tiny whitish bump on most species, and they use that to chisel a little perfect ring around the centre of the egg. And if you find eggshells around your garden, and I found a few wood pigeon eggs in my garden, they look almost like little white ping pong ball shapes in a way. They're a bit squatter than a hen's egg would be. If you see them broken into two fairly neat halves, that's a sign that a chick has hatched successfully out of that egg. If you find an egg where it's kind of smashed and broken, and especially the liquid coming out of it, that's a sign it either fell down or a predator got it and crushed it before the chick hatched. So they're usually two nice spheres, and when they've hatched out properly. And when they come out, they're all bedraggled and wet, and they recover quite quickly, but usually the exertion of having come out of the egg leaves them pretty exhausted. And they may not be able to feed in some cases even for a couple of days. A lot of small songbirds, they're fed almost immediately because they're so hungry. But some of them still have the remains of the yolk sac still inside their bodies, and they have a couple of days nutrition while they absorb it. So some species of duck are like that. The ducklings in the first couple of days may not need to feed. They still have that yolk. It's only when that's gone, all of a sudden they become hungry and they start to feed themselves. But you can also, it's really amazing how they do this. What I find really interesting about that too is some birds have very underdeveloped chicks when they come out of the egg. So they're like, if you look at the little blue tits or robins or blackbirds in your garden, they're blind and naked.
Totally
and helpless.
Headless, yeah.
And they tend not to be in the egg for very long, and they have quite a small yolk in that egg. So that's used up quickly and then they hatch out. But other birds like ducks, pheasants, and including the chicken, which is a species of pheasant, they tend to have much bigger yolks. Their chicks stay in the egg a lot longer. But when they hatch out, they're much more developed. They're precocious, as we call them. And they're able to run around within a few minutes and walk, and they're often responsible for feeding themselves from day one. So they're far more alert, their eyes are open, and that's because there's far more yolk in those eggs. And it's no coincidence that those are the species that were domesticated preferentially by humans, because the bigger the yolk inside the egg, the more nutrition that's in there. So it made sense to domesticate chickens and ducks rather than blackbirds and birds like that, because there wouldn't be so much nutrition in the eggshell. So that's one of the reasons why they're so commercially successful.
Yeah, and waders are quite independent very early on as well.
Yes, and there used to be a long tradition of eating wader eggs. So plover eggs, also gull eggs, were widely consumed. Thankfully, that's illegal today. A lot of our breeding waders are doing terribly, so they can certainly do without people eating their eggs. But yeah, they're another good example of that. Their eggs are quite big. Have you ever seen an oyster catcher egg? I don't know how the poor female even lays that thing. It's so massive compared to her body size. And that young chick, as soon as it pops out, it's running around within a few minutes. They're very, very active. But that's always a prime example. That egg is so much bigger than you expect a bird of that size to be able to lay.
Apparently, eggshells now are thinner than they were back in sort of the post-industrial revolution. They're now thinner because of acid rain and that influence. So I'm now saying that today's chicks are kind of like suffering of millennialism.
Right.
That they're softer than the pre-industrialization because they have like thin eggs. They just kind of jump out of.
Too much avocado toast, that kind of thing. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Compared to back in the day when it was like basically a steel egg you had to fight your way out of. I don't know how negatively it's impacted on bird populations. I'm sure it's in certain regions and stuff, it is quite probably, it has affected certain species, but it is an interesting fact. The other thing about the shell and the calcium carbonate is the females have to recruit it from somewhere. It doesn't sort of, they don't just absorb it from the atmosphere. So, different bird species have different techniques, and depending on their diet, of course, like the likes of seabirds are fine because they're constantly eating fish and they've got all the bones, and that's fine. Owls are the same because they've got the bone from all the small mammals and stuff, so they seldomly sort of lack it. But there are, like, for example, like the blue tit, which can lay up to sort of 14 eggs. There's way more calcium for her clutch required than she has in her own actual skeleton. So, like, where does she find it?
Yeah, it's a really important point, Ricky. The calcium dependency that female birds particularly have around this time of year is absolutely enormous. And if she doesn't have enough nutrition, she won't be able to lay any eggs. And what will happen as well is if she doesn't have sufficient calcium reserves in her body, some of it will leach out of her bones to produce her eggs. And that can shorten her lifespan and makes her less likely to succeed as a mother. So it really is very, very tough. So one of the things that I love to watch out for sort of in the springtime particularly is I have in my garden, I have a couple of stones I put out for the song thrushes. The song thrushes are birds that famously eat snails. One of the only birds we have that can do that, because snails have this hard protective shell. A bird's beak usually can't break that. The song thrushes know what to do, though. They pick them up, they smash the snail shell on the stone or on the patio, break it open, they leave fragments of snail shell around. And if you watch out carefully, you'll see lots of other birds of many different species coming in and actually swallowing little fragments of snail shell. And those are generally female birds in advance of the breeding season that are craving calcium. They absolutely need it. In the same way, I believe that pregnant women will often crave really strange foods. You hear pregnant women sometimes wanting to eat chalk. Chalk's really high in calcium, and it's this bodily craving to what you need for your offspring's own nutrition. And it seems to be the same with birds. So in one really cool way, you get song thrushes going around and benefiting all the other birds accidentally, but it's a really wonderful way to show how nature is interconnected and all linked. But you will see their diet changing. You will see birds like blue tits going around eating different kinds of insects. A lot of the calcium that they get, it actually comes from the plant's material contained inside the bodies of the caterpillars and the other insect larvae that they feed on. So it really is amazing. Interestingly, with blue tits too, that's where they get most of their colour from. All the greens and the yellows come from the vegetation inside those caterpillars. So their diets are really important to them. But yeah, you'll definitely see them. They really switch their diet in advance of the nesting season because it's such a big burden on them. And to the extent you'll even see birds like female cuckoos, for example, famously lay their eggs in the nests of other birds. Very often what they'll do is when they land in, they have to remove one of the eggs, obviously, so they can lay their own. So the same number is there. They'll often swallow that egg. So they're using its nutrition, the calcium and also the protein in the yolk, to produce their next egg.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Another example of a species that absorbs, acquires calcium from themselves is the red knot, or the knot as we know them, because they're up in the Arctic. I mean, sort of breeding and stuff, and on the tundra, there's probably very few sort of sources of calcium. I don't know, but the other thing is sandpipers up in the Arctic, they will forage on the sort of teeth and bones of lemmings found from predatory skuas. So the skua sort of eats the lemmings and other small birds and stuff, and then coughs up like a pellet, like owls do, or birds of prey. And then the sort of sandpipers come along and forage on those for the calcium, and that's their source, which is quite clever.
It's amazing, isn't it? And when you're talking there about the migratory birds, you know, the waders particularly heading back to the Arctic, to that tundra, which is a very sparse landscape, very few predators, which is why it makes sense for them to be there, quite a lot of insects for their young, but yeah, very little by way of calcium for the parents there. So birds like the knot and the sanderling and the dunlin, birds like that, curlews as well, I always find it amazing. When they're here in Ireland for the winter months, and they're feeding on all the little invertebrates on places like Sandyman Strand or Harper's Island, or wherever it may be, they're swallowing in many cases, you know, little tiny micro snails and little crabs and other things like that, swallowing them down, and they have calcium in their shells, and that's the very calcium that then they transport in their bodies back to the Arctic to create their eggshells. So those eggs were basically made from calcium that came from beaches and estuaries around Ireland, which I just find amazing. It just shows you how connected we are to that world and how important that winter feeding is for them. So it also shows you as well, Ricky, when those birds on the beaches particularly, when they're disturbed by dogs or by walkers who are careless and let them all fly up, that can have a really serious impact on their breeding success, because if they don't get enough calcium, and also if they're burning up fat and also using a protein to keep fleeing and they're in a state of stress, they'll lay fewer eggs as a result, and then the population tends to decrease. So we all have a responsibility to help them when they're feeding. It's all about production of eggs, really.
We give budgies those cuttlefish bones.
Yes.
That's probably a mistake, because really only breeding budgies would really require them. So we probably just sort of got into a habit of giving them, thinking they need it, but it's probably just the female budgies needed in whatever when you go to breed them. But it's very funny. The pet shops do well out of it anyway. Maybe it's, they don't want to give away the secret.
Yeah, maybe so. And I guess with captive birds like that too, the budgie it can only eat what its owner gives it, rather than in the wild where they eat a wider variety of food.
Sure.
I guess. I mean, all birds do need calcium to a degree for their bones and so on. But the females obviously need more when they're laying. But I think a lot of it is habit as well. And the budgies seem to like it too. They can use to sharpen their beaks. But I know you're right. I think that sometimes one of the reasons why when people try to hand rear birds in captivity, they find what they think is an orphaned chick. In many cases, it's not orphaned at all. The parents are still looking out for it. But they feed it just one kind of food, or they feed it too little. And that bird, even though it might look normal, because feathers cover a multitude of problems below the surface, you can't see that the bird is malnourished, but it's actually not getting the right amount of calcium or protein. And the parents instinctively know exactly what kind of food their chick needs at each stage of its development. They know, okay, junior needs more caterpillars this week, or more spiders next week, or whatever it may be, and maybe it's time to put them onto plant material and seeds at this stage. Whereas in captivity, we're not quite so nuanced or sophisticated in our understanding, which is why for a lot of those young birds in captivity, they tend not to do so well.
I presume one of the reasons that birds lay eggs is because they couldn't fly around with a growing fetus inside them. It would just drag them down, and it would make it dangerous for both the mother and the baby. It would make them more vulnerable and slow and turgid and everything. So it just makes more sense to evacuate the baby early and do the process sort of externally.
Yeah, I think that's a very big part of it, and that's why it's been so successful for so many birds. In fact, for all birds at this stage, there's no other mating strategy with birds. It's something we know that came from their dinosaur ancestors, because birds and dinosaurs are the only known vertebrates, you know, animals with backbones, that were known to actually lay hard-shelled eggs. All other vertebrates would lay soft eggs, shelled eggs. Many of them are kind of leathery and squishy, including the very few mammals that still lay eggs, like the platypus and the echidna. With birds, yeah, that hard-shelled egg, I think it's certainly, yeah, with those big embryos, a bird embryo is a big thing when it's growing, it develops like that. If the mother was having to carry around a belly full of these things, it would really reduce her ability to fly. And I think that's a big difference between the birds and most mammals, for example, is that the mammals, they need to be agile, but except in the case of bats, they don't need to fly around the place. And so the weight isn't quite so important to them. And it also is an insurance policy for the female in particular as well, because if something attacks her nest, she may lose that clutch of eggs. And that's a disaster, of course, but she will live to breed another day. Whereas if she was carrying all this weight around inside her, she might not be able to flee that predator, and her offspring and herself would both perish. So it seems to be a sort of an insurance policy to make sure that at least the mother survives.
The size of an egg is all relative. I mean, you don't get the biggest egg in as you mentioned before is ostrich, and the smallest is the bee hummingbird, I believe, and that's supposed to be half the weight of your standard paperclip. So you're talking like minute. You'd probably like you'd pass them by. They're tiny little things like Tic Tacs, I suppose. But generally, it's on average about 20% of the mother's weight is the size of the egg. Which, if it was human, if you applied that to humans, the average baby would be 30 pounds. And I think the average baby in real life is about 7. So I think a lot of women out there are blessing themselves that they aren't, the average babies aren't 20% of their weight. That's just
one egg. So it's like, you know, or one baby. So imagine having 7, 8, or 20 of those all in one go. It wouldn't work. And if you think about it though, all that material that's inside those eggs, that 20% of the mother's body weight or whatever it may be, that all has to come from her own bodily resources. All of that protein to make up the white and the yolk, all the fat that goes into the yolk and all of that stuff, all the calcium, that has to come from her body and from her own diet. So that's a huge dietary requirement. If she's basically investing 20% of her bodily resources into creating this egg every single day for the whole laying period, it might go on for a couple of weeks for some birds. It really is phenomenal.
Tell me about the shape of eggs.
So the shape of eggs, everyone knows the shape of an egg. It's sort of pointed at one end, more round at the other end. And as we said, it's the rounder egg end that actually is laid first and comes out of the oviduct that way. Most birds, their eggs are roughly analogous to the shape of a chicken's egg. Some like pigeons and some of the game birds are a bit more squat. They're still more pointed at one end than the other, but or a bit rounder. Some seabirds, like guillemots and razorbills, they have very elongated eggs, like an egg stretched out. So more pointed at one end and round at the other, but much more expanded and stretched out. And this is a really efficient shape for a variety of reasons. So it's not quite cylindrical, because that would be pretty much impossible for the female to lay. It has to be rounded so at least she can get the thing out. But it does mean that she can very easily turn it, or indeed the male in many cases will also incubate. They will turn that and they'll have it in contact with a patch of bare skin on their bellies called the brood patch. They can transfer their bodily heat directly into that egg and keep turning it round to make sure that it's evenly heated, which if an egg was, let's say, square, that would be much harder to do. So that hasn't evolved in birds. But the other thing as well is that it's reinforced at both ends. An egg is a really strong thing. So we think of an egg as being quite brittle, but in fact, for its weight and its components, it's actually incredibly strong. If you hold a chicken's egg at either end, you know, the pointed ends, and squeeze really tight, you won't break it. It's really, really strong. It's only at the side, if it gets a sudden knock or a blow or too much pressure, that it'll break. So it's a bit of a trade-off too. If any thicker, any heavier, the female might require too much calcium, it'd be too hard to lay. But the shape of them is really important to sort of the engineering of the strength of that eggshell. It really is a really perfect combination of layability and strength, and also breathability too, because it has to maximize the surface area so enough oxygen can get through to the embryo inside that's growing and breathing all the time. The shape of it is just, it's incredible. An engineer couldn't design anything more perfect.
The different groups and families have kind of typical shapes, like owls, for example, are very round. Seabirds, like guillemots, kind of have this very sharp end and a very blunt end, and that's supposed to be an adaptation that they don't roll off the cliffs. I don't know if that's the case. You might be able to tell me more. And then a lot of sort of in the middle, really, that typical sort of egg, oval egg shape that everyone is familiar with. So why are owl eggs and sort of raptor eggs rounder and just sort of white?
I suppose with many of them, especially owls, they're often tucked away high in a tree or in a nest or in a barn or something, so that they don't need to be quite so colourful, because the parents tend to be active mainly at night when it's dark, so often they'll be incubating during the day, so they're hiding the eggs themselves. That's part of it. In terms of the shape, it may be something to do with laying, it may be to do with the shape of the oviducts and so on. The fact of it is that evolution can only, you know, it's a very random process, so things can only develop by chance. So it could just be that color never developed in these species, because their ancestors never had this. It just hasn't evolved. So that may be one part of it. Certainly when it comes to eggs like the guillemot, these very elongated ones, they are laid certainly in very precarious positions. They're laid on cliff ledges, and so there's a chance that they could roll. Now, there's been quite a lot of work done on this recently, and some, nobody's quite sure, but some ornithologists think that actually that rolling thing may not quite be true. Because it is true, if you get a guillemot egg and you roll it round, in a circle, it will roll in a circle, but it tends to be quite a big circle, and most ledges would be much narrower than that, so they'd fall off. So the current thinking is that it may actually be more to do, first of all, with the shape of the female's body, how she can lay the thing in the first place, because she needs to have a very, very well developed egg, because her chick, when it comes out of the egg, it's quite advanced when it hatches out. It's one of the precocial ones, not quite as much as a duckling, but still very, very, very well developed. So she needs to have a lot of yolk, and there needs to be a big egg. But her body is shaped like a torpedo in the water to make a streamline for swimming. So she can't really, the theory is, at least lay squat eggs. They have to be quite elongated so she can actually develop inside her body and lay them with her narrow body. But the other theory then that's gaining ground as part of that is that when the parent auks, like the guillemots and razorbills, when they're incubating those eggs, they have to lie their bodies on top of them. And the length of the egg, that long elongated shape, it means that they have the maximum amount of skin contact with that brood patch on these ledges where space is at a premium. So that's one of the theories behind it. But the thing I think that I find most fascinating about guillemot eggs, it's not so much the shape, although that's amazing, it's the variety of colours. So all the birds, they're the one that seems to have the biggest variety in terms of the colour patterns. Some are very spotted, some are all squiggly, it looks like someone scribbled on them with a marker pen, some are, you know, different colours at one end than the other. It's really, really varied. And the theory behind that is, and it seems to hold water, is that it's an adaptation for birds that live in massive, massive colonies where there's thousands, or sometimes tens of thousands of pairs, all nesting side by side. That female will recognize the pattern of her own eggs. They might look completely different from her neighbors, even though they're the same species. And that's how she knows, and the male knows as well, that those are their eggs. And so they sort of imprint or bond with those eggs in a way they don't with eggs that they haven't laid.
The cuckoo. We know birds mimic different, they mimic other birds and other sounds and stuff. But a cuckoo has to be able to somewhat mimic the egg colour and shape of the host species in the nest. So they tend to specialise, don't they? So in this country, it's sort of In Ireland, it's the likes of meadow pipits yes. they go for. In other countries where there's more wetlands and stuff, they might go for reed wobblers and sedges and stuff like that. But so for a meadow pipit, it's sort of a small brown egg. Now, the cuckoo's egg will be slightly bigger, but they can get quite close in colour to fool the host parents.
Yes, that's right. Because for many of these unwitting foster parents, if the egg looks too different, they'll reject it. So, you know, if you had a nest of like brown speckled eggs and all of a sudden there's this glossy blue thing in the middle of that, a lot of those birds would be like, there's something amiss here. I'm going to abandon this whole egg. I'm being compromised. I'm just going to cut my losses, go start a new nest somewhere else because something's gone wrong here. They don't realize it's a cuckoo, they just realize something is off. And also it seems some other birds don't. So sometimes cuckoos, if they're desperate, they'll try, you know, if they can't find their normal host species, they'll lay the egg in a random bird's nest. Most times that fails, but sometimes some birds aren't observant at all because they have never been parasitized by cuckoos before, so they haven't evolved this mechanism where they recognize the color of their own eggs. The colors there is evolved for camouflage, but not for parental recognition. But people wonder how the cuckoos do this. Well, there's no conscious thought that goes into it. The fact is that, as far as we can tell, the cuckoo is imprinted on her own foster parents. So if she was raised as a chick by meadow pipits, she will then seek out meadow pipits to lay, because that's what she knows. And evolution over thousands and millions of years even has that female lineage produce eggs that have evolved to look like meadow pipits, because the ones who originally tried this, the ones who had the eggs that most resembled meadow pipits, even if it was only slightly, that gave them a survival advantage, and their chicks were more likely to survive and be cared for by those foster parents. They would pass their genes on to the next generation, and so evolution perfected this. And we know with cuckoos, some work has been done on their genetics, and this colour pattern is inherited entirely from the female line. The male plays no role, contributes no genes at all to the egg formation or egg colour. So it's almost the way it works is that the female cuckoos now, they behave almost like separate species, separate evolutionary units, where they have their own type of egg coloration for their own host species. But what keeps the species together is the male, because he'll mate with any of the females, and she doesn't mind because he's not contributing anything to the colour of the eggs. So any male cuckoo can mate with any of these females, and the eggs will still be the same as the female her whole lineage has laid for generations and generations back. So it's really fascinating that this happens and this whole process has evolved. Now, cuckoos aren't the only brood parasites that we have in Ireland. Many ducks do this as well. But the reason why that hasn't been such a strong selection pressure against the eggs there is because when a duck, even of a different species, lays its eggs in the nest of another duck, it isn't a huge disadvantage for that foster mother, because she doesn't invest any time or effort in feeding her own chicks. They feed themselves from day one, so it doesn't really affect the survival chances of her real chicks. So it's not such a problem. Whereas, obviously, for a cuckoo, when a cuckoo lays its egg in a foster parent's nest, it's a disaster, because all of that chick's own genetic offspring will be destroyed, either by the female cuckoo herself, who'll take one of those eggs and eat it, or then by the cuckoo chick who hatches out and heaves all the other eggs, or indeed some of the hatched chicks, over the side to their deaths. And of course, when you see this happening, it's amazing, because the foster parents, they just can't compute what's happening. They just watch on, bemused, as far as we can tell, but they don't intervene. They never stop the cuckoo chick from doing this. So it's really amazing how this has evolved. It's just one of the most amazing things in all of nature, I think.
So it's not just me and you that are fascinated by birds and eggs. They've been sort of fascinating people for hundreds of years, to the point where it became a problem at one point, where egg collection was a massive thing, and it actually decimated like huge colonies, nearly wiped out. It probably wiped out species in certain countries. I don't know if it was ever a huge thing here, but certainly in Victorian Britain, it was the sort of thing to do for gentlemen. And some eggs, and guillemot eggs especially, and because of their variation, used to fetch big prices. And now, because of those egg collections, a lot of them have ended up in museums. Some of them were destroyed because they were illegal and all sorts. They even stopped publishing books about bird eggs for a while, because it was sort of encouraging or educating people how to find the right egg. So tell me about egg collecting.
Yeah, it was a big problem, and it still persists in some areas. It's particularly a problem in parts of Britain. We never had a huge tradition of it here in Ireland. It went on, but not to the same extent as it has, particularly in many parts of England, where it became a huge problem, many parts of the continent as well. I think it does stem from that Victorian collecting mentality. The Victorians were obsessed with collecting stuff, and naturalists particularly, they wanted to collect as much much as they could for their glass cabinets. And it wasn't enough just to take one egg. You had to take the whole clutch to check for this variation. Now, the thing is, with those eggs, what they'd do is they'd make holes in either end of them. They'd blow out the contents. And when, you know, it's kind of gross if you think about it, but when that's done, that eggshell, if it, you know, it will preserve pretty much forever. That calcium carbonate shell will retain its colour. They're really these amazing structures. So that's actually how we know things. Like, as you mentioned earlier, we know that for some species, their eggshells have got progressively thinner over the last century or so. It's because we have those old Victorian egg collections that were actually able to measure that. So it does have a scientific purpose today. And I do appreciate that at the time when this was happening, a lot of those birds were far more common than they were than they are today. And thankfully, in Ireland, it was outlawed in the 1950s. A small amount does still go on. So, you know, some of our tern colonies, as you know, Ricky, we have to be careful because there have been attacks by egg collectors in the past. People have come in to try and take roseate tern eggs or little tern eggs for their collections. And this is terrible. And one of the big problems as this continues, and still continues to this day in some places, the rarer a species becomes, the more valuable its eggs become. So it got to the point where with the great auk, for example, a now extinct flightless seabird that used to occur in Ireland, one of the big reasons why that went extinct was because of egg collectors. And as the species became really rare, people went out to say, well, you know, this species is on its way out, so I'm going to get one of the last eggs ever. And of course, when they're doing that, in the very act of doing that, they're condemning that species to extinction, but therefore also increasing the value of their collection. So it really is quite sick. And that actually is one of the reasons, as you said, why it's actually quite difficult to find information about birds' eggs. One thing we both experience a lot in Birdwatch Ireland and on our social media and so on is people often send us photographs of eggs in a nest in their garden. And we have a blanket policy of not helping people with that. And people think we're really mean or it's awful. It's, you know, the fact is, disturbing a nest it causes real problems for those birds. It's actually illegal for people to take photographs of a nest. But also, you don't want to be encouraging egg collectors. You don't want to know where that information will end up. So it's something that we just have to be very firm about. We always have it on our social media this time of year in Birdwatch Ireland. We're always asking people, please not to send us pictures of eggs or indeed chicks in the nest, because it's breaking the law, but also because although people don't intend any harm in most cases, they are causing harm because that nest becomes more vulnerable, and because predators may find it or the parents might get stressed, and because those female birds in particular, because those eggs are outside their body, they're not carrying them with them, they're not as tied to them as a mammal might be to a growing fetus inside her body. They will abandon them more easily because they think, well, I've got to live to fight another day, so I'll just abandon this clutch of eggs and we'll lay again, because it's not worth the risk. So that's one of the reasons why we don't entertain questions about eggshells. It's different if we find one, if someone sends a picture, one that's obviously found broken on their lawn or something, it's hatched out. That's a bit different. And it's a good time of year actually to find those eggshells, because what happens in many cases is the birds themselves will carry the hatched eggshells out of the nest. The parents will carry them away and drop them, both to save space in the nest, but also because the inside of those eggshells in most cases are white and they reflect the light and make the nest more visible to potential predators. So they want to clean up the nest. So it's a good time of year to find hatched eggshells. But certainly if you find it well away from a nest, taking pictures is no problem, but going near the nest itself is a big issue.
Let's do a quick bird of the week before we wrap up. Let's do it because they have such cool eggs. Let's talk about guillemots.
Oh yeah, so guillemots, this is a great time of year to start getting to know them. Just to start preface this by saying, at this time every year we get emails and Facebook posts and letters from people telling us, I've just seen a couple of penguins swimming around in my local harbour or on my local beach, and then one of them flew. I didn't think penguins could fly. What people are seeing, they're seeing guillemots mostly, also a related species called the razorbill. They're members of the auk family, closely related to puffins, and the guillemots, they nest on these high ledges on cliffs around the Irish coast. And indeed throughout much of the North Atlantic. It's a real North Atlantic species. In fact, you find them in the Pacific as well, but in this part of the world it's very much the Atlantic and parts of the Arctic too. And they spend most of their lives well out at sea, so they've evolved a very similar body shape to that of a penguin. It's what we call convergent evolution. So guillemots and penguins aren't closely related, but both of them spend the vast majority of their lives swimming in the open ocean, diving down to great depths to catch fish and trying to avoid predators when they're there. So they've both evolved a body shape. It's very elongated, a bit like a torpedo, so there's less drag when in the water. They have their feet set far back on their bodies, because that makes more sense for steering. And unlike all other aquatic birds, penguins and auks, which include the guillemots, they fly underwater with their wings. So most aquatic birds, they kick with their legs. What the guillemots and their fellow auks do, and the penguins, they flap with their wings under the water, and that propels them really very quickly. And flying through water and flying through air, from the point of view of the physics, it's more or less the same thing. It's just, if you think of water as being a much thicker fluid than air, which is what it is, that explains the mechanics of it. Though they're still using the same sort of lift and propulsion forces to move through it. So that's why they've evolved very similar body shape. And that's why both penguins and guillemots, they have this very upright stance, because they're very front heavy. Their legs are set very far back. So they waddle around like little waiters in their black and white suits. And the reason why they're both black and white is because it's camouflage from both fronts. A lot of seabirds, including guillemots and penguins, they tend to be white below and dark above. And that's camouflage on two fronts. So when they're swimming in the water, or in the case of the auks, but not the penguins, when they're flying, a predator like a skua or maybe a falcon looking down from above, it sees the black part, the dark part of that bird above. It blends in with the dark ocean below. It's much harder to spot it. But from below, potential prey like fish and squid, but also potential predators like sharks, when they look up, they see the white belly and it blends in with the bright sky above the water. And so it blends in from that point as well. So that's really, you know, why guillemots really look like penguins. So I'm not surprised people report them to us. But unlike penguins, they fly very well. And now's a great time of year to see them on our sea cliffs.
Yeah, and I suppose a good place to go see them, a safe place, a good accessible place, is the Cliffs of Moher. And you get your puffins there and your razor bills and your black guillemots as well. So you get all the Irish auks in one spot, and it's a lovely place and easy accessible. So yeah, that brings us to an end. That's another good episode, and that was the bird eggs. It was fascinating.
I really enjoyed that chat there, Ricky. So people, just to say to you all there, now's the time of year to go and pay attention to any eggs that you might find dropped on your lawn. But just to reiterate, please stay away from the nests. And just to say, as we always do in these podcasts, if you enjoyed this and you're interested in birds and have got this far in our series and to this episode, you must be interested in birds, at least to a degree. Please do join Birdwatch Ireland. We really need your help to save these birds, to support their habitats, to do research into them, do conservation projects, do education work and lobbying around them. And when you join Birdwatch Ireland, that's what you're supporting. Not just financially, although that money is incredibly important to us as a charity, but the more members we have, the more clout that gives us to talk to politicians. You know, the minister will take our calls if we have members to back up what we're saying. So that would really make a big difference. So you go to birdwatchireland.ie, you'll find all the details there.
And the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, and is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.